I got it from an old doctor, George. George Crane. He used to write a column called The Worry Clinic, and he was a rather well-known physician and psychologist, and he wrote psychology books that got published all over the world, and he would write these short columns in the newspaper that they paid him liberally for, and his two sons went on to be congressmen. But he once wrote about how he took care of depression, and he got it from an old doc. It's always great to get stuff from old docs. And the old doctor told him this. He said the first thing that he would do for depressed people was that they had to read a chapter of the Gospel of Luke every day. Now, why did he pick Luke? Let's see. It was professional courtesy. That's right. Yeah, that's right. And so he had to read a chapter of the Gospel of Luke every day. They had to go back to work because sitting at home did not help them in their depression. They had to go to church. They had to go to church. They had to go out and walk 2 miles a day. That was another part of the cure. And the last part of the cure was a Christian service assignment. And the Christian service assignment was that you would go help someone who was worse off than you were. It had to be someone. It couldn't be just washing windows at church or cutting the grass. You were actually going to go help a person. And that person had to be worse off than you are. They couldn't be a relative because there's always secondary gain from doing something from your mother-in-law. And so it had to be for not a relative. And then you couldn't take anything from them. They couldn't pay you. And you would do this for an hour or two a week for the rest of your life. Now, what did that do? What did that Christian service assignment do for that depressed person? It got their nose out of their own belly button and into the life of another individual. That's exactly what it did, and it helps. Purpose. It goes to the heart of purpose. We change their motive. You change their motive. I want to glorify God with my life more than I want to breathe, and then you give them purpose, something to do that matters. And that's why Jesus said when he was talking about washing dirty feet, now that you know these things, happy are you if you do them. So, Christian service assignment. Now, let's talk about dying. Hopefully I won't kill you before the lecture is over. So it's not just living well, it's finishing well, isn't it? Life is just full of people who do rather well through, and then they become proverbial. And you know, at the end, you find out that they were really bad people. And they were really bad people all along, but you find out at the end. It's like a famous comedian that we know of that my kids used to only get watch one television program a week during school, and it was a half hour long, and they could watch Indiana University basketball games because those were important. That was back when we had good teams. But of course, and we thought that the television program was great because we thought that the guy was actually for real. And what we found out later was that Bill Cosby wasn't. He lived ostensibly well, and he finished horribly. Yeah, he finished horribly. So how do we make it to the end finishing well? Well, there are examples in the Bible. Abraham finished well. It talks in Genesis 25, 7 through 10. He finished satisfied with life. One of you mentioned this. These are all the years of Abraham's life that he lived, 175 years. Abraham breathed his last and died in a ripe old age, an old man satisfied with life. Satisfied with life. He didn't need to live another day. That was what Abraham thought. He'd had it. He'd done just about everything there was to do. He'd had enough, and it was good enough to go home. Compare him to Hezekiah, who, when he was told by God that you're going to go home, which meant he was going to heaven, that he turned his face to the wall and boo-hooed. And then God gave him more time. What was it, 10 or 15 years? 15 more years. And how did it turn out? Yes, they turned out badly. You know, he would have been just as well advised to call it quits when God called him the first time, as opposed to hanging out another 15 years and ending poorly. Well, Abraham finished well because he finished satisfied. And I would tell you that finishing strong requires an attitude of gratitude. It does. The book I like about gratitude is Choosing Gratitude by Nancy Lee DeMoss Bogomuth. It's an excellent book. I encourage you to get it for counselees who are struggling with sadness. and with difficulty in life. In it, she says, not me, she says, you have two choices in life. You can either whine or you can worship, and you get the choice. It's one or the other. As one African-American preacher that I heard on a day when I was having a really ugly day, and it was in the middle of that big problem that I had, and I'm driving down the road to the car shop to get my car fixed, and he's preaching on Moody Bible Radio. And all of a sudden he says that it's time for you to quit counting your bruises and start counting your blessings. I said, yeah, this guy has my number. He knows what I need at the moment. So finishing strong requires an attitude of gratitude. Then Moses finished strong. You know, you look at Moses in Deuteronomy 34. It says Moses went up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo to the top of Pisgah, which is opposite Jericho. And the Lord showed him all the land, Gilead as far as Dan, because he wasn't going to let him go in. He wasn't going to let him go in because he busted up that picture, didn't he? Yeah, he was supposed to speak to that rock that second time, and it would be Rock of Ages, cleft for me once, not twice, not three times, not four times. The Rock of Ages cleft once. And because he refused to obey God and speak to the rock second time, which would have been a picture of our relationship to Christ, Moses didn't get to go into the promised land. But it says, so Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab, according to the word of the Lord. He got to see it. He didn't go in. But I tell you, I think Moses was satisfied with it. I do. Because even though it meant that he didn't reach his goal, it was probably important to him that the nation Israel made it in. You know, sometimes you finish well because you decide that the goal that you had in mind isn't the one that you're going to get to, but the goal that you need to get to, glorifying God with your life, and is the goal that you're working towards. So finishing strong requires that we put glorifying God with our lives ahead of our goals in life. Then Paul finished with confidence, didn't he? Finished well. 2 Timothy 4:6-8. And he says, for I am poured out as a drink offering, and the time of my departure has come. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the course. I have kept the faith. In future, there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award me on that day. And not only to me, but also to all who has loved his appearing. Paul finished with confidence. Finishing strong requires us to remember that where our reward is going to be. This world is not my home. I am just passing through. My treasure is laid up somewhere beyond the blue. The angels beckon me from heaven's open door, and I can't feel at home in this world anymore. We probably sang that song growing up, didn't we? Yeah. And that was Paul. Paul knew that the reward for the work that he was doing on earth wasn't here. At least it wasn't showing up in his bank account at the time, was it? No, it was in heaven. So finishing strong requires us to remember where our reward will be. And then another good example is our Lord, who in John 17 in the Garden of Gethsemane said, I have finished the work. He was done. He'd done it. His 3 years were about up. He had about 48 more hours left to go. And then nailed to the cross, on the cross, he said, tetelestai, it is finished. So finishing strong for our Savior meant being diligent at his work. He came to do the will of the Father. He did the will of the Father. Despite being tempted by Satan in Matthew 4, with skipping the plan, you know, changing the plan in some way that might have made it easier for him, he chose to obey the will of the Father. And I would tell you that if we're going to finish well, we're going to spend our lives doing what God's will is for our lives. All right. So now, how can we find a good ending? It's out of John 11, as I think I already told you this once, but it's good to review. It's that four-part sermon with Martha and Mary and Lazarus. And if you're going to finish well in life, there are four really good elements. One is to know. You have to know something about what the finish is going to be like. I would say that for most of us in this room, it means that we're going to need to talk to an attorney. And maybe we're going to have to talk to our financial advisor if we have one. And also, we need to consult our pastor. We need to know what a good end looks like. We need to know what it looks like from a biblical viewpoint. We need to know how we want to arrange things medically. You know, this is the only time in your life that you're going to be able to tell people what you don't want them to do to you when you're unconscious. You know, if you wait until you're unconscious and you're in an emergency room, it's over. You know, you don't get to tell anybody anything that you want. If you want them to know now, you have to tell them now. You need one of these things. I got to get it out so I can show you that I have it so you won't think I'm a hypocrite. What do you think this is? Anybody out there want to guess from a distance? It's a living will. That's right. And what does it say? It says that my wife can tell them whatever she wants to about what they want to do to me. That's pretty much what it says. I guess I'm at her mercy. So if you want to determine what people will do for you at the end of life, now is the time to tell them, not to let them guess when you are unable to speak. So you have to know, then you need to plan. That requires a will. It requires you telling your physician what it is that you want done. It's a good thing for you to have a living will with your physician. So you need to be doing your planning. And you know, it also is kind of wise to plan the funeral. Do you want to save your kids a lot of grief? Do you want to save them a bad day at a funeral home? Yeah. Well, just go down to the funeral home yourself and write the check and figure it out what you want done and pay for it. And that way, then they don't have to sit there and try to figure out if they want the $10,000 casket or the $1,500 one. You know, see, how do we want to bury? You know, and so they're not going to be making those kind of choices if you want to make those choices a little bit ahead of time. So you could do that kind of planning as well. Then you can care. As we said, Jesus cared for Martha and Mary. You can care about others enough to talk to them about it. Talk with them individually. You know, you need to figure out who's going to be your quarterback for your the final plays in your life, and you need to tell them what the plays ought to be. Yes, you need to do that, and then you need to carry those things out, acting, doing, putting those plans into effect. Now, those are four good elements to a good ending. Now, how do physicians, I think this is useful. How do physicians, from a medical ethics viewpoint, decide what they're going to do for you? Good question. And there are four principles that are supposed to govern us. I once was asked to speak about medical ethics. I never had a lecture on medical ethics in medical school. You know, I'm certain they do today. I suspect they talk about all kinds of things that we were expected to just absorb. I can remember while I was in medical school, we never had a course or a lecture about writing prescriptions. Never. Never once. My wife, who's a dental hygienist, they made her learn how to write prescriptions. She doesn't write prescriptions. She has no prescriptive authority. But we were just supposed to learn it off the guy ahead of us. You know, the intern shows the medical students, see one, do one, teach one. There's a lot of medicine that goes on and gets handed down that way. And so I don't think I ever had a medical ethics lecture. And I would say this about medical ethics. Your medical ethics are tied to your general morality. And that's why medical ethics is in such a difficult spot these days. You know, our medical ethics in the United States were ruptured in about 1973, wasn't it? That's when we decided we could kill babies. Yes, yeah, abortion. If you don't think that didn't rupture medical ethics in this country, you just don't understand. Why? Because if you can kill children, you can kill adults. That's what it eventually comes down to. And eventually, if the Lord tarries and things keep going the way they are going, we will kill adults. That's... You can look for it. It's in Europe and elsewhere in the world. So your medical ethics are tied to your general ethical principles. And what are the ones that we currently hold to? Well, there are four principles that govern physicians. One of them is respect for autonomy. That means that I, as a physician, am supposed to ensure that a patient can exercise their right to make an informed decision. I don't make decisions for patients. And I enforce that. I'm sitting there with them in the immediate care center. They're having a headache. They can't make up their mind where they want to be there or in the emergency room getting a CAT scan of their head. And I smile and tell them, your neurologic exam is normal, but it is your choice. It's not mine. And I'm not going to tell you what to do. And eventually they make their minds up. And that is the way it ought to be. I ought to give you all the information in the world you can understand and give it to you in the best way I know how. And then you need to make the choice. That's so that you're autonomous. Now, what passage of scripture do you think I might rip that out of? Sounds like it's thundering outside. It's definitely quiet in here. You know, I never thought of using that verse. Let's try Romans 14. The principle of Christian liberty. I think that's where it comes from. But, you know, that's a unique interpretation of that passage. We appreciate it, brother. Yes. So, I let people make their own choices. The next principle is beneficence. Beneficence means that physicians have to act in the best interest of the patient. That's a 1 Corinthians 10:24 issue. Nobody should seek his own good, but the good of others. That is what I'm here to do. That's Philippians 2, Jesus Christ, Philippians 2, 5 through 8. Let this mind be in you that was in Christ Jesus, who submitted himself to the will of the Father, went to the cross of Calvary so that we could have salvation, and who's highly exalted as a result. So we as physicians are to act in the best interest of the patient that has asked us to care for them. Not the insurance company, not the government, not the hospital, not in my own best interests, for sure. We must act in the patient's best interest, and I would add, not in the family's interest either. And sometimes that is a rather tricky place to be. My duty is to the patient or to the person that he has designated to make those decisions for him. That's my sole duty. I don't have any duty to anybody else in the process. And sometimes I find myself crossways with relatives who want to argue about what is going to be done. And I just have to say, you know, and I've done it before. I've looked into the eyes of the patient and say, do you want me to take care of you? And they say, yes, then you need to tell your family that I'm going to take care of you. And they did. So I've been in that unenviable spot. Then there is non-maleficence, which sounds a lot like a Disney movie. Maleficent? Yes, non-maleficent. It's primum non nocere. I think that's how it's pronounced. Of course, it's really tough to know how Latin is pronounced since nobody's speaking it these days. But it means first do no harm. Whatever we do for patients is for their good. I won't help anybody kill themselves. Never have, never will. I don't care what kind of law they pass. Doesn't make any difference. And so far, the American Medical Association still stands on that. Physicians have no business executing people. They have, although there have been times that I've known criminals that I probably would have thought that I might have wanted to pull the trigger, you know. But as a physician, I am not supposed to do that. It's my job to save life. And if you always work to save life, you never get confused as to what you're supposed to be doing. And no one will ever confuse what you're doing. So that's what we're about. We're there to save and preserve life. Now, this includes not doing things in medicine that you're not particularly good at. Yeah, it's what Hippocrates says. Don't cut for money. Don't do things you're no good at. You just send those things to someone who is. Don't do things you don't do much. Send those things off to somebody who does it a lot, because that's how you are good at it. That's what consultants are, and specialists are for. As Paul would tell us, we are created in Christ Jesus for good works. That's what we're supposed to be about. So non-maleficence, and then there's justice. Did I get it? One back. Justice, yes, justice. What that means is that all patients are treated well and fairly, and health resources will be used equitably. You know, it's like, as my friend Larry Jones used to say, as an old electrician, he'd say, you ought to cut the pie in the same all the slices of the pie in the same size. Everybody gets the same slice piece of pie. That means that everyone gets a reasonably fair opportunity to be cared for. These are the principles that are supposed to guide us as physicians. They are the principles that are supposed to guide us as Christian physicians. James would roundly criticize those who would put rich people on the front row and the poor people in the back. And we are not supposed to do that. So those are the four principles and ethics that we are supposed to use as believers. And they come out of the Bible. I guess that's the best way I can put it. They just simply come out of Scripture. And why would we be surprised? Now, how do you make a decision as an individual when you are faced with a medical problem? Well, it's the Johnson four-box model. You know, this may be more than some of you wanted, but it'll be helpful to you. At least you know how our minds click in medicine. Let's take a good example, the one that's not too hard to use. My father, who had prostate cancer. It was sort of a sad sort of thing. You know, I could save my dad from heart disease. I could save my dad from cancer, and only for him to die of Alzheimer's. But when in his 70s, he had prostate cancer. The first thing that we would decide are what are the medical indications. And in this box goes the principles of beneficence and non-maleficence. In other words, I'm going to do whatever we choose to do for you, for your problem, is going to be for your good. And we're not going to do anything to you that'll hurt you without benefit. We cannot say that we are not going to do anything that won't hurt. You know, in medicine, there are times when we have to hurt people because if you don't take their appendix out, they'll die. You know, and there are times when you have to do heart procedures that require you to open somebody's chest up. And then if you don't open it, they're going to die. And so the pain and suffering that they'll go through as a result of whatever you do for them, it will be balanced off by the benefit that comes from it. So what you need to know out of that in order to do a good job of it is, let's move on here. I can almost barely read that back there. So what's the prognosis, including survival and function of quality of life? When it comes to treating patients who have disease, the question is what can I do for you and how's it going to come out? You know, if I tell you have cancer of the pancreas, and, you know, if we work really hard, you might live 6 months to a year, but your 6 months to a year are going to be rather uncomfortable. You know, there would, you know, some people would look at that and say, you know, I'd really just rather take pain medicine and forget about it. Or if it was like my dad, who had prostate cancer and his choices were radiation or prostatectomy or doing nothing, you know, he looked at it, he'd had a dad and two brothers who died of prostate cancer, and he didn't think that was so much fun, so he took radiation, which really did work out well for him. It did cure him. It didn't really leave him with any residual disability. He didn't have any problems as a result of having done the treatment. So, you know, those are the two choices that you get. I would say that there is always good reason. There's always good reason to opt for treatment. My cousin had cancer of the pancreas. She had a grandson. She had a daughter. She wanted to live as long as she could. And so she was in a experimental treatment program, which actually shrunk her cancer of the pancreas until she developed blood clots, which got her booted out of the study. And if it had been me, I would have looked at him and said, just go right ahead and give it to me. And if I die of the blood clots, I'll be happy with it. But they took her out of the study, and then eventually she died. Now, there were lots of good reasons for her to opt to do that chemotherapy, which was really pretty rigorous. And one of them was that she wanted to live longer with her grandchild. And the other is that if we don't press against the boundaries, we never figure out how to fix things. Medicine is always doing that. We are always pressing against the boundaries of cancer and other diseases. And what we're trying to do is figure out a better way to take care of it. When I was in medical school between 71 and 75, the raging controversy was whether treating children for acute lymphocytic leukemia was ethical, because it made them miserable. It caused their hair to fall out. They vomited their socks off. It was miserable for them. Of course, but what we didn't know at the time was that they were being cured. If we'd have had that piece of information, it would have been an easy decision. Now, looking back on it, the answer to the question was obvious. You know, it was right to opt for treatment. On the other hand, there are always good reasons to opt out. You know, the short time I would gain isn't going to be worth the struggle or the suffering that I'm going to live with. And that's just as reasonable a choice. Then the next question is how certain is the prognosis? You know, the patient needs to know how the diagnosis is made and how certain the prognosis is. You know, it's like my dad had a prostate mass, and he had an elevated PSA. And once they did his biopsy, the diagnosis was really pretty settled. And what his outcome might be was fairly straightforward. Then they need to know what other treatment options exist and what the benefits and the burdens of those treatments will be. You need to know what the downside is and what the upside is. And then finally, they need to know what the potential benefits and burdens of palliative focused treatment is. If chemotherapy is no bargain, then can you make me comfortable? As I said in the last lecture when I got all wound up and on my soapbox, you know, as far as I'm concerned, people who have cancer, they, you know, I'll write them a prescription for anything that makes them comfortable. You know, if that's what they want, I have absolutely no qualms about that. The patient needs to know that if they don't want to do chemotherapy, that yes, we'll do everything in our power to make you as reasonably comfortable as we can. Then, the next thing that falls into the mix is patient and family preference. Patient and family preferences. The principle here is respect for autonomy. And this is where this can get kind of tricky. I can remember one family, a gentleman that I took care of, put him in the hospital, did a CAT scan of his head, and he had a brain tumor. And the family, I was telling the family about it, and they told me not to tell him. Now, he was a perfectly lucid man who could make decisions on his own. And I thought about it for a moment and said, can't do that. You know, no, I don't know how long he's going to live. It is not my job to withhold that information from him. And and they were definitely angry with me. I went in and told him, and after he got out of the hospital, never saw him again, never saw them again. Now, you know, I think I might have done better at it. I think I did what I was supposed to. You know, very basically, I think I did what I was supposed to. I won't withhold information about a fatal illness from anybody unless they tell me to. You know, and you know, there I may have had some wiggle room. And what I probably should have done was gone and talked to the patient first and said, you know, if we're going to get this CAT scan done. And when it's done, and if there's anything in it that's bad, do you want me to tell you or just tell your family? Which do you want? Now, I could have done that. And when he said, oh, no, I want to know, or no, just tell my family, then I would have had his direction as to what to do with the information, and I wouldn't have had to infuriate anybody. Or I could have said, you know, I asked your dad about this, and he said he wants to know. So I have to honor his decision and bear whatever it was. So what are the family preferences? And again, how much does the patient want to know? And then the next thing is, how involved does the patient want to be in the decision-making? Discussing questions like this, you know, need to be done with the patient before there's a need to make a good ending. You know, these are the kind of questions you want to talk over as a physician and as a patient. You want to talk over with your physician and with your family as to who you want this information to go to. I know that every time my wife goes and gets something at the hospital where I work, that it's against the HIPAA law for me to go look in her chart. And so she has to go sign a paper. You know, I started practicing a long time ago, and none of this stuff existed. But anyway, I can't get her information without her signing that HIPAA thing off and telling them, yeah, tell my husband whatever it is. I want him to know. So those are kind of questions that need to get taken care of with you as a patient, with your physician, and with your family. And then the last thing you need to know is, does the patient have decision-making capacity? You know, can the patient actually make a decision? You know, while my father had Alzheimer's, we were fortunate enough to get him to sign off on his power of attorney before he got to the point where he couldn't sign anything. That was really a very good outcome, because after he can't sign for anything, then it gets to be very very complicated as to what you're going to do. then if the patient doesn't have decision-making capacity, then the next question is who's got it? Who's legal? You know, who has been appointed either by the court or who was appointed by the patient to make that decision? And those are the kind of decisions that need to be made well before the need. If you wait until you need it, it's really way too far past in the game. And the last thing is, has the patient expressed a need for, or have they signed a living will or a power of attorney? So then moving on, the next thing that gets decided in the four-box model for Johnson is the quality of life. And in this, it's the principles of beneficence, non-maleficence, and respect for autonomy. I'm not going to hurt you. I will do good for you, and you're going to get to make the choice. And at this point, what you're asking the patient is what's most important to them. Is time more important for them, or is quality of life more important for them? Is cost more important for them? You know, the question is it, you know, I have $1 million in my 401k program that's going to support my wife for the rest. I don't. I'm not talking about me. This is hypothetical. But let's say I had $1 million in my 401k program, and that was going to support my wife for the rest of my life, and I had a disease, and there was an experimental program that cost treatment that cost $750,000. Would I think about that before I did this experimental treatment that maybe had a 10% chance of survival? Well, you bet your sweet life I'd think about that. I wouldn't want to spend my $750,000 and leave my wife in poverty for a 10% chance to survive. Now, if it was 100%, I'd probably say, well, you know, we can eat pork and beans together, yes, or something or other. But so what's more important? What is the patient hoping for? My dad was hoping for a cure. What was the patient fearful of? My dad was fearful of dying of prostate cancer. What was the patient expecting out of the treatment? They were expecting for aggressive care. And it was the physician's job at that point to explain the trade-offs on all those things for my dad. And then the decision was up to my dad, who chose the radiation. The next thing is, are there quality of life states where it wouldn't make any sense to continue life-sustaining treatment? My mother has absolutely, positively told me that she does not want to be on a ventilator. She does not want an endotracheal tube, and she doesn't want a feeding tube, period. Which won't make the situation easy for me, but it'll make it a lot easier than if I didn't know those things. And I would tell you that if you do not want to be on a ventilator, if you do not want a feeding tube, if you don't want to be kept alive in a nursing home by artificial means, you need to tell your family right now. Tell them right now, because this will be the only time you get to tell them, you know. And a lot of people don't want to do that because they are fearful of dying or fearful of what the outcome will be, and they don't want to think about it. But I can tell you this, if you don't, it's coming anyway. You know, this is one of those kind of things in life that if you just don't think about it, it's still going to come. You know, it will be here eventually for you. So you don't want to ignore it. And then there are contextual features that go into our decision making. And again, this is the principles of justice. You know, you want to know if the carrying out the care for the patient is going to cause significant distress to the staff, like in the nursing home. One thing that I learned early was that the nurses in the nursing home were profoundly sad when their patients died. You know, and it didn't quite strike me that way. But then I realized, well, these are people that they have taken care of, perhaps for years, and who they've come to know well, and many of them that they like and love. So you need to take that into account, and then you need to keep in mind what the family dynamics are going to be. There was a recent case for a living will thing where the loved one had filled out their living will saying, I do not want to be kept alive by artificial means. Part of the family was good with that. Part of the family wasn't. It ended up in court, and the patient won. Yeah, the patient won. Why? Because the patient had well in advance said, these things I do not want done. And then the last thing is, are there economic and financial factors that must be considered. What's really, you know, things like access to hospice care, what's really kind of sad is that most people on Medicare who are, most of the people who are dying, you know, I'm that age, actually. And they, and of those who have terminal illnesses, they rarely get into hospice before a couple weeks before they die. It is because most of us don't want to admit that we are in one way, shape, form, or another. Then, are there religious and cultural factors involved? I know that I've read, I've not experienced it myself, but I know that folks who come from, who are from China do not wish to be told that they have cancer. You know, that's one thing that I know. And I often, I also know that, that African-American individuals can be very distrustful of the medical establishment because they were treated, they have been in times past treated poorly. In fact, I can remember once, and it's not always true that that anybody's being discriminated against. I worked in a place in Indianapolis where I had a large African-American population, and they were Christian people. They found out who I was. They found out I was a Christian, and so they came. And it was great. I enjoyed it. You know, there are times when I was sad. I'm sad that I left. I should have stayed. And but I can remember one lady who came in who was accusing a surgeon of discriminating against her because she was African-American. And it's not an unreasonable thing to say, but I listened to her say it. And then after a while, I said, well, let me tell you this. You have to understand one thing about this surgeon. He is a non-discriminatory jerk. that nobody gets treated any better by this guy than you did. that what was going on had nothing to do with race and had everything to do with, he's just a miserable person. I endeavored never to use him again after that. So are there religious or cultural concerns? And then are there problems that relate to the allocations of resources? You know, the question is how, you know, with Medicare and insurance, you know, they're really, you know, where this probably comes to bear most is on organ transplants. We have all kinds of people on organ transplant lists. I hear commercials for a university in Pennsylvania that advertises and says, we can get you further up our transplant list. You know, I really don't know how they do that. And I really think it's unethical for them to advertise that way. But it illustrates what we're talking about. You know, it is like, who's on the transplant list first? I can tell you this, it's much more equitable today than it was when I was a medical student. When it came to renal dialysis in the 1970s, there was one guy at IU or two who were making the decisions. And all of us would scratch our heads as to the people that they chose. And we really didn't think that everybody was getting the same kind of deal, that the choices that were being made were being made very subjectively. And the thing that ended it was, you know, for of all people, was Senator Edward Kennedy. Not that I would have ever proclaimed him as a great example of much of anything, except he got a bill through that said that, no, we'll pay for everybody's dialysis. And that ended the choice. Anybody who wanted to be on dialysis at that point could be on dialysis and Medicare would pay for it. And it ended the choices that had to be made about care like that. The other thing, particularly for us as physicians, whenever I transfer somebody to a different emergency room, I have to sign on a line that says that I don't own part of the emergency room I'm sending them to. And I don't. I don't own part of any hospital. So there's no risk of that happening. But it's the same thing for MRI scanners. You know, if I own an interest in an MRI scanner, if I send you to that MRI scanner to get your MRI, I have to inform you that I own part of it. And I also have to have you sign a form saying that I told you that I own part of it. I don't own a part of anything. I decided early, at some point in life, I decided that I didn't think that selling people things besides my professional opinion was a good idea. I just decided I didn't want to do it. So, now, how do you plan for a good ending? Well, know what you want. And, you know, you need to know what your options will be, what you'll want to be done and not done. And then you need to also know to whom you're going to delegate it. You need to decide who you're going to tell, what it is that you want done. And you need to remember Hebrews 9:27. it really is appointed unto man once to die, and after that the judgment. And if you ignore all this stuff, walk out of here and forget it, it's still going to be there. You are still going to meet that appointment. And you can either do it in a way that helps your family, or you can ignore it. Then you can plan. You can plan, and that includes living wills, powers of attorney, a will, health insurance, insurance for final expenses, prepayment of final expenses. My wife and I have nursing home insurance. My son, who's my financial advisor, saw to that. I don't know what his interest was in getting me. Maybe it was he didn't want me to live with him, or I don't know. But anyway, we have that kind of health insurance that pays for the nursing home if I get to the point where I can't live on my own, or Helen can't live on her own. Then you need to care about others. If you can show that you care about them if you make these decisions ahead of time and tell them, so that they won't be sitting around some kitchen table arguing about it. And then you can act. You can actually do something about making this kind of decision. Make those arrangements yourself. And if you have parents who haven't made them, go talk to them. You know, tell them, you know, I heard this lecture and this guy kept saying that you need a living will. You can blame it on me. All right, we're done. And it's question time. I think, well, let me look. Somebody's going to come and tell me what time it is. 2:30. No, we have, you're going to have a...
I'm going to give two microphones to the floor so they can ask you questions.
All right, that's good. It is question time.
I'm going to get your chair.
I'll be happy to sit down. Yes. They're getting you a microphone. Well, yeah, you'll need one. Everybody else needs to hear your question. If they can't hear your question, then it doesn't help the whole crowd.
Test. Okay. Can you speak a little to the medical community giving medication to older people to prolong their life, but it doesn't actually equal a quality of life?
Well, you know, since I started practicing medicine, I always viewed that my job was to keep people alive. That has always been the bottom line for me. I have, from a biblical viewpoint, I have always looked at death and said, it's the last enemy. It's the enemy. I have never subscribed to the idea that dying was anybody's friend. There are lots of people who would disagree with me with that regard, perhaps philosophically, but that's how I think. And so my brain runs in that direction. I don't know what kind of drug you're talking about that would prolong their lives, but you know, most part of the reason why the Social Security system in the United States is struggling is because we as physicians have done our jobs extraordinarily well in several arenas, and one of them is hypertension. It's a rather inexpensive drug. Lisinopril is, you know, $5 a month. If you don't have a stroke, you don't end up in a nursing home. It doesn't cost thousands of dollars a year to take care of you. So, you know, when I look at taking care of people and their medical problems, my statement to most people is, you know, you really don't want to have a stroke. So why don't you take this medicine? Because the reason why you don't want to have a stroke is because you don't want to end up in a nursing home, because you're really not going to be very happy there. And it's really expensive. So, you know, actually trying to treat people for their medical problems, And in the process, extending their life, as far as I'm concerned, is less expensive than not. You're welcome. You're going to vote with me. No. Yes.
I have a comment and a question. My comment is back when you first started about helping people less fortunate than ourselves as part of the therapy. I believe another thing, too, is that God places people in front of us sometimes, and he's saying, you dummy, see how blessed you are? You could be as bad off as this guy.
I used to, when I was working in Indianapolis and I didn't have places to send people, I would send women to the Mother's Club where my wife worked at Wheeler Mission, where the mothers might have had several children by different fathers and had half their teeth, and they were all on public assistance and welfare. These were women who were living in like $750,000 to $1 million homes, and they were dysphoric because their husbands weren't paying enough attention to them, et cetera, so on and so forth. So I'd send them down to talk and work with ladies who didn't have a husband and had lots of burdens and were living in a shelter. And you know what? Most of them came back smiling. You know, it was sort of like they needed to reset this idea of how life is for it to be more in reality. So yeah. That's why I like Christian service assignments.
Yeah. All right, my question is, I've heard where people have strokes or something, and they say that they're withholding food and water from this patient, and it almost seems like they're euthanizing them.
Well, it comes down to autonomy. And it, you have to be careful how you say I'm withholding food and water from people. And it's always a sticky wicket if you haven't sat down and written out what it is you want done ahead of time. If an individual says, I do not want to be fed by artificial means, if I can't eat or drink, I do not wish you to feed me by artificial means because I do not want to continue to be kept alive in a nursing home, then the courts have said that that is their legal privilege. It really only became much of an issue since about 1980 because, honestly, before 1980, we really couldn't keep people alive very well for prolonged periods of time with tube feedings and things like that. And, you know, the thing that happened was that our technology got better with regard to artificial feeding, and we could keep people alive. And then suddenly somebody was going to make a choice. So I don't know if I've answered your question, but I've rambled on for a bit about it. All right. Next. Yes.
Is there a genetic component to bipolar or a genetic sin pattern to be sinful behavior?
A genetic pattern to sinful behavior. That's an interesting question. I always smile and say everything's genetic. I said that in a meeting once, and I had to apologize to somebody over it. They put a complaint into the ACBC because they had mistaken what I was trying to say. I mean, everything about you is genetic. Come on, think about it. Yes, your brown hair, your blue eyes, your height, your skin color, everything is genetic. That's what I meant about it. Is our propensity towards sin genetic? Well, I think we're all born with a sin nature. It's appointed unto man once to die, and, well, no, that's not it. Wherefore, as by one man sin entered the world, and death by sin, so death has passed upon all men, because all have sinned. And Romans 3:23 says that we all sin. So, before we come to know Christ as Savior, our bent is towards sinning, and we don't have an indwelling Holy Spirit that enables us to really resist much. So, if you're asking me, do I think somebody's genetically doomed to commit murder? My answer to that is no. That's not what we're talking about. Do I think that anybody can lie, cheat, steal, commit adultery, kill, do any of those things? The answer is yes. Anybody can. Now, do I think the genetic for bipolar disorder? We haven't outlined what the genetics of bipolar disorder are at this point in time, but it does seem to run higher in some families than others. The problem, though, that you end up with is the lax definition of bipolar disorder. You know, just about any family that you can think of will have somebody who's been called bipolar at some point in time, and then all of a sudden then anybody who shows up in your office and is depressed can remember the aunt so-and-so was at one time labeled bipolar when they didn't have mania. So that's when I get very specific about asking individuals, what do you mean by bipolar disorder? And one very remarkable thing, as far as I'm concerned, is that most people who have the label of bipolar disorder don't know what kind they have. You ask them, what kind of bipolar disorder do you have? They don't know. They don't know if they have one, two. But if you ask them about mania and describe it to them, they'll usually tell you whether they've had it or not. And if they haven't had it, then you know that they're in one of the other categories. So there may be a genetic component to manic depression. I don't know about, I don't think the rest of it there is in particular, in the same sense that there is an underlying genetic defect. If you go back in Science Daily about 3 years, you can find the article that leads you back to the research that was done in Boston that located the genetic defect at C4 in the complement system. There's some really very solid genetic evidence about schizophrenia. All righty. Yes.
You gave some reasons or things to help with sadness or depression. One of them was be active or get busy doing something.
Yes.
Is there benefit in that activity being physical?
Like absolutely.
Exercise?
Entirely.
Walking around the golf?
What?
Walking around the golf, that'll help.
Yes. Walking. Yeah. What is it? Mark Twain said, golf is a good walk spoiled. Yeah. So physical exercise in research studies has shown to be equally as effective as many of the first generation SSRI antidepressants as far as cures for depression are concerned. You know, if you only have to get to about 25% on a cure rate to equal sertraline or Zoloft, then physical running is probably as good as taking medicine in that regard. So, yes, physical exercise is huge. Big important compliment. In the back? Back on the right. Yes.
Hi, thank you for coming today. My question relates to nutrition and its role in some of these disorders that you're talking about. For example, I've heard that food additives and artificial colors contribute to an ADHD situation.
That's very child-specific. You know, there are some children who will be allergic to red dyes and stuff like that, but it's very child-specific, and it does not apply across the whole of it. Now, the problem with ADHD is that it is a big bucket, and lots of kids get heaped into it that have different problems but have similar symptoms, which means that you can have some children who struggle with food additives and other children who have big tonsils, but they're both going to get the same level and probably get treated the same way. And so, you know, I had one lady not far from here whose son had particular trouble with food dyes and food additives. And when they took him off of that and started going to Whole Foods, that he could go to Sunday school again. So, you know, it did make a difference. It will not make a difference to every child. It's not the silver bullet. It only applies to those who are allergic to it. Next.
Hi. How willing are doctors to check for the different ailments that you had listed when people think that, when they are depressed, well, they think that they're depressed, like for the sleep apnea, the Cushing's disorder, lupus, all of those kinds of things? Is it hard to get them to test for those things?
You know, I don't think so. I think first you have to have a good relationship with your family physician or your internist. And I think, you know, what I usually tell folks that I see is that you need to go to your doctor and you need to tell them, you know, I'm in counseling. The doctor wants me to have a good medical workup because I'm having some emotional struggles. I'm not particularly wanting to take medicine, because if you walk in and say I'm having emotional struggles, some people have a reflex and they reach for their pen and their prescription pad. And while you're still talking, they're writing you the prescription. So you want to tell them, what I really want to know is there an underlying medical problem that might explain some of this? Would you mind just, you know, spending some time talking to me? And when you make the appointment, you need to make it for a complete physical, and you need to tell them, I may need an hour, and then smile and say, I'll pay you for it, you know. And I would make the appointment in that kind of context. And I think that, well, you know, it depends on your doctor. You know, when you say how willing are they, it depends on what kind of situation they're in practicing and how much time they have. But if you've known them for a while and they've taken care of you for a while, they may be more willing to do that. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yes.
Tagging on to the nutrition question. I'm right.
Yeah. disembodied voice.
Would you just speak to the general idea of nutrition and how it plays a part in mental illness, physical health in general? What are you seeing is important or things to remember with nutrition being such a big emphasis right now? Thank you.
Well, I think it's always wise to eat well. No, I can't say. There have been times when people have said, he must eat a really good diet, and that's because they don't know me. The reason why I run is because I started running when I was 19, dedicated to the proposition that I wanted to eat cherry and coconut cream pie anytime I wanted to. And it worked well for me until I was about 60. And it's not working well for me right now. But I think it's always wise to eat a well-balanced diet. I can't say that I think that people are probably going to find much of a dietary solution to problems like depression. It'll usually be the other way around. Whatever their sadness is will be affecting the way they eat, and they'll eat poorly because of it. But I think if you eat the best diet on the face of the earth, it's probably not going to solve whatever problem was that has made you sad. So that would be the one comment I would make about it. Nobody thinks in medicine thinks you ought to eat badly. One, nobody thinks you ought to be overweight. Two, and those things both will have an impact on your health and well-being. If you weigh 50 pounds more than you should, and you roll over on your back at night and start snoring, and you quit breathing at different times, it's going to have a significant impact on your health in general, and a significantly bad impact on your health in general and your emotions. So, diet, I think, plays a part, but I can't say that I think that it would be an absolute source of a cure. Already? Somebody over, people over this direction next, I think. Yes.
Yeah. Can you speak to what family members can do to encourage those who are suffering from PTSD beyond veterans, other kinds of traumas outside of military trauma? But if you have family members who've gone through, some other
difficult
stuff.
Times, yeah. Well, probably a very important thing is to encourage them to see someone who can help them with counseling and who has some ability in it. Because not doing anything about it is not a very good strategy. Holding up and walling up about it is not good. And this is true both for military and for civilians. Family support, the idea that my spouse is going to stick with me or my family is going to stick with me through the problem, I think is is vital. I know when soldiers come back, that they do well if they come back to their unit. They do better if they come back to their unit than if they are reservists or National Guards and they get dispersed into the general population, because they lose the support structure. So, I think understanding your loved one's difficulties, having an understanding of it and being supportive of them, in the process is important. Encouraging them to avoid things that make their situation worse, like not working, isolating themselves, drinking, alcohol or substance abuse, things like that, trying to encourage them away from those things. It is a military example, but I have a good friend who was a Marine and came back, and he had post-traumatic stress problems, and the way he dealt with them is he'd just drink himself unconscious every evening. And that went on until his dad recognized it, and his dad was a World War II tank a person, and one day my friend got up and his dad was waiting on him and he said, I have you a job. You can't keep on doing it this way. And that was the beginning of his making it. Someone who recognized what his problem was and then sought him to help him, and even if he didn't want to help himself. So you want to extend that question a little? Or?
In terms of flashbacks or triggers, you know, how do you help a person to overcome eventually just, you know, the triggers that come out of nowhere? Or
yes. Yeah. Well, I can tell you what another friend of mine did. He calls it the propeller drill. And I teach this to people a lot. And what you have to do is you have to attach a different meaning or memory to the event. You know, usually when people are having flashbacks, there is a memory associated with the picture that's in their head. And what has to eventually happen is you have to put a different narrative to that picture. So my friend was working, I'm sorry, but it's military. That's the best I can come up with. I do have another one I'm trying to help right now. It's not military who's having flashbacks. But the issue is that he was working on the deck of an aircraft carrier, and which is a pretty dangerous place. And one of the five people working on the helicopter turned and went the wrong way and walked into a propeller on an airplane. And my friend and the other four people were standing there, and swoosh, you know, they got sprayed with the guy. And if you spray water in his face to this day, he will see that. Poof, just like that. Now, at the outset, it was pretty distressing to him. You know, anytime he would have that flashback, it would be pretty distressing. And on his own, he had become a believer, and on his own, he decided that whenever that happened, the first thing he would say is, one, this vision is not real. You know, it's not happening right now. The second thing he would say is, this vision can't hurt me. And then the third thing he would say was, whatever God has for me now or in the future will be for my good and his glory. And then the fourth thing he would say was 1 John 4:18, perfect love casts out fear. And every time he had the flashback, that was the statement that he made about it. Now, prior to that, what was his narrative? His narrative was, this is dangerous. An awful thing happened to my friend. And you can construct a gospel narrative to go with that, you know, to go in that slot for the individual who has post-traumatic stress disorder. But the deal was, is that every time he had the flashback, he did the drill. And over time, the emotional content leaked out. You know, you're still going to see the pictures. I don't think anybody forgets anything in life. I think our brains, until they become old, decrepit, and start getting damaged by strokes and all kinds of stuff, I don't think our brains forget a thing. And but you can attach a different narrative to it. And I think that is, you know, for me, that's a biblical way to deal with this. I think, you know, probably similar principles are used in trauma-based cognitive behavioral therapy. Probably similar stuff are used in eye movement reprogramming, desensitization. The idea is you're attaching a different narrative to the picture. You can't make the picture go away, but you can put a different narrative with it. Does that help? Okay. The 4 points in the propeller drill. Number one, this vision is not real. It's not really happening at the time. The second is, this vision cannot hurt me. The third is, whatever happens to me now or in the future will be for God's glory and my good. And the fourth statement was, perfect love casts out fear. That's 1 John 4:18.
A couple more questions. And then.
So, quick question, Dr. Hodges. Can you talk about the relationship that we could or should have as biblical counselors with the medical people? I'm curious of what you guys talked about at your luncheon, but from a biblical counselor perspective, how can we and or should we have a relationship with a doctor?
Well, up at Faith, we've been very fortunate. I'm there. Dan Wickert's there, Mark Bono's there, Bob Smith has been there for decades, and that has allowed us to be a part of the counseling ministry. I usually get the medical problems. Dan or I, one, get the, or Mark, get the people who have struggles that have medical labels attached to it. So having a physician in your biblical counseling program is a gift. Now, I always smile at any physician that I ever meet who has any interest in that, is that take what you know and go do something meaningful with it. You know, that it's like everything that we do has meaning, but the work that you can do to help in biblical counseling is a big deal. So I always try to encourage counseling programs. If you have doctors in your church, do your best to see if you can recruit them. Not everybody is called to this. You know, that you need to keep that in mind. Counseling is a calling. I think for us in the general practice of medicine, maybe the calling is it's a little closer. You know, primary care medicine matches up to counseling in lots of ways. And you know, taking a good history, we do that every day. It's just part of who we are. Whenever you can encourage that relationship, it's a good thing. If you're not fortunate enough to have a physician in your church, then I encourage you to try to find a Christian physician in your community that you can talk to and say, you know, at times I have questions about medications, and at times I have questions about labels. Could I call you? Would it be all right if I called you and you could tell me what you know about it? Or could I send you an email and you could answer me back? So...
Can you hear me? Okay. You spoke a little bit about ADHD. I was really curious if you had any opinion on autism spectrum disorder and the new classification from autism to that title.
Well, autism is a, I have a good friend who's a physician who has a son who has autism. On Thursday or Wednesday, I had a little kid come in who obviously had autism problems and who was swearing he couldn't breathe. And I sat with him, and for a while I'd just breathe quietly, and then I'd say, could you breathe with me? Could I just see you breathe with me? You know, this kid's 8 years old. And before it was over with, he was breathing with me. And then he was breathing normal, and then it wasn't really about breathing. And then I got to look in his throat, and you know, you have to have time to help individuals who are in that. The problem with autism is the same thing with ADHD. Children, you know, can come everywhere from being unable to sit in an area like this and listen to people talk to just being mildly affected. I really like... Oh, I don't know if I should say this or not, but have anybody ever seen the movie The Accountant? No? Yeah, some of you have, yeah. And in it, he's supposed to be autistic, and he's great with numbers, but he's not a very good man. But anyway, but the point of it was, and it was a point that Rob Green made, is that people who have autism will have a limited range of gifts, and sometimes those gifts will be spectacular, and then they have significant disadvantages. And the problem is that since we can't, there is no good way to validate the diagnosis, it is hard to make, it's hard to make the diagnosis, and it's hard to get it right. Now, this year I've been supervising another a pastoral intern who was counseling, and we had a fellow who had autism. He's 19, and he was getting into difficulty in church and in public places. The mother wanted me to counsel him, and I said, no, but I have an intern, and he'll counsel him while I sit there and watch, you know. And so that was good for both of us. And as he counseled him, what we figured out was that this kid could memorize anything. And that gift had not been exploited by his parents. You know, it was they pretty much let him do whatever he was going to do, which was bad for them, bad for the parents, bad for the kid, bad for everybody involved. And what we found is that he could actually memorize scripture, and then we could actually hold him accountable for what it said, which made a significant difference in how he would respond. He still lacks social skills. That's all you can say. He comes running at me through the church foyer, and he'll be smiling and yelling at me and telling me something that is a little bizarre. That's a good way to put it. And just smile, shake his hand, and he keeps on going. But at least he's not doing things that gets him in trouble at this point. You know, I think the issue is to understand the individuals. What is it about them? What is their gift in the middle of this problem? And then exploit it. There is a company called Gordon Foods. I don't know if they're down here or not, but if you haven't noticed, unemployment's down below 4%, and it's getting hard to find people to do anything, which is great if you're looking for a job. Actually, it means that they have to bid up the price of the wages, and those of us who work for a living, it's a great thing. But what this has also meant is that they're now hiring people that they wouldn't hire otherwise. And they're hiring people with disabilities because they can't find anybody else to work. And there was this kid who had autism who couldn't get a job that amounted to much of anything, who actually was very good with numbers. And Gordon Foods needed somebody to follow the numbers on warranty cards. And he could do it. He could do it better than anybody on the face of the earth. And so they arranged the job in such a way that he could do that. That was what he did. They constructed the job around his skill, and then they tried to construct the environment so the rest of his lack of social skills wouldn't get him fired, you know, or something like that. And what grew out of that was that they started looking at all handicapped people in that way. And they said, you know, you want a job? Come here and we'll test you, and we'll try to figure out what you could do for us, and we'll try to figure out how to make accommodations so that you can do it because we need people to work. And, I think that approach, the approach that we used with the young man, recognizing his narrow gift and trying to work around his significant social disadvantages, and what Gordon Foos does, I think that's, you know, from a biblical counseling viewpoint, that's the way to help the families and the individual.
Last two questions.
Back to the diet.
Wait. She's first. Yep. Her microphone got to her first.
It's in regards to marijuana. You talked about that. Did you say that marijuana could cause actual physical disorders and schizophrenia? And also, how would you counsel people not to smoke it now that it's legal in a lot of states?
Oh, okay. Yes, I said it actually causes physical disorders and psychosis. It changes people's brains. If you look at MRI scans of young people who smoke it over a period of time, what you find is that there are portions of their brains that start changing. It is associated with increased incidence of bipolar mania and schizophrenia. Probably the last bipolar young man I saw was smoking a significant amount every day until he became manic. He was the guy who wanted to buy the car wash and was giving waitresses $200 tips, who now is taking three drugs and really struggling with life because he smoked marijuana every day. And then the other thing is what part of it is it like, did they say smoke? Let's see now, smoking. Have we just spent billions of dollars in the United States trying to convince people that smoking is bad for your health? Yes, we have. So, you know, the idea that smoking marijuana is suddenly safe and smoking tobacco isn't is sort of ludicrous on the face of it, isn't it? Yeah, I think smoking marijuana will prove to be just as hazardous to your health over time as smoking tobacco. Do I think that research ought to be done about the constituent ingredients of marijuana to see if any of it actually helps people? The answer is yes. There probably are some small areas like intractable seizures in children that the CBD portion of the drug can help, but it isn't without its downside. If you smoke marijuana for 10 years and you take an IQ test when you start, and you take an IQ test when you finish, you will be dumber, period. It lowers your IQ. And you know, anybody that has had a friend who's done it, you just go, oh, yeah, I watched that guy go from here to there. And now he's probably, you know, he struggles to drool. But anyway, there's that. And so if we're going to give people marijuana constituents, it really would be nice before we do it if we know what the significant downside effects might be before we start into it. And then it is addictive. There is a really good article that was published in the Hillsdale College Imprimis. And it's a book, a review of a book written by a guy named Berenson, which is Warn Your Children, I think was the name of the book. I could be wrong, but you can find it under the guy's name Berenson. And what it outlines is the violent crime that is committed by people who are psychotic while they're smoking pot. And these are terrible crimes. They're not little crimes. These are violent, horrific crimes. And these people end up in institutions. And so, you know, you look at that and you go, you know, and nobody's talking about that because everybody wants to make money selling marijuana and make money out of the misery of other individuals, and they want to tax it. You know, it's like they like to tax liquor and tobacco. I always say, how do they tax poor people in the state of Indiana? And the answer is it's cigarettes and lottery tickets. Yeah, lottery tickets are direct tax. Some people never figure that out, do they? Like, what are your odds of winning the lottery? It's like getting struck by lightning on a clear day. Maybe you were more likely to be struck by lightning on a clear day than to win the lottery. And so, you know, all those poor people line up on Saturday evening. They buy their two packs of Winston's and their lottery ticket, then so on and so forth. That's what the drive is behind marijuana. There are people who want to make big money out of it. Will it increase crime wherever it goes? Absolutely. Just go to Colorado where it's legal. Right now they are struggling with the effect of everybody comes to Colorado to smoke marijuana and smoke pot. So there you go. That's my opinion. I guess I'm not.
Okay. Yeah. Well, now I'm right here, sir. And now I have two questions based on that. So you said CBD is like the new snake oil. So if you can speak to that. But my original question was about our diet and nutrition and supplements. So do you have an opinion on supplements and the deficiency of supplements? We're all supposedly D-deficient. But does it affect the brain and our mood and so forth?
Well, there are some studies that have been done that show that if you're low on vitamin D, that you're possibly more likely to be depressed than people who are not low on vitamin D. They were done out in Washington State, where it is almost impossible to smile because the sun never shines. I couldn't live in Seattle. It would not. I just couldn't do it. I couldn't live in Alaska either. 9 months of winter, couldn't do it. But the question is it actually connected to the vitamin D, or is the vitamin D going up and down and being low just also happened to coincide with the fact that the sun's down? It's always a problem of causations versus correlation in medicine. Things that happen at the same time are not always related by cause. But I always smile and say, take a good one-a-day multiple vitamin. No, you don't need to buy whatever they're selling, whatever multi-level marketing is going on. You should avoid please forgive me if I've offended you. One good-a-day multivitamin, maybe take 100 units of vitamin D, drink your orange juice, or take a vitamin C tablet. But you don't need to really spend $200 a month taking a bunch of stuff. It's probably not going to measurably change your outcome in life. Eat a good diet, get 8 hours of sleep, do those things, and you'll probably do well. Now, CBD oil is untested and untried for the most part. It's being sold in the state of Indiana in almost every flea bag front storefront that couldn't sell anything else right now. And I have patients who come in the droves who are taking it for this and that, and they swear by it. Of course, who would know? Who would know if it works? Why? Because 30% of everything anybody takes will make them feel better, whether it has any bearing on them getting better or not, because of the placebo effect. So I just say, if we're going to sell stuff and people are going to take it, it might be really good. You know, prior to 1963 or 1964, you could sell medicine in the United States and you didn't have to prove it did anything. The reason why we have an FDA now, which is much maligned and much misunderstood, is because I think Lyndon Johnson, the Johnson administration, passed a bill saying that if you're going to sell a drug in the United States, one, you have to have a disease that it's supposed to treat, and two, it has to be shown to work. Two basic things. Nobody's ever done that for CBD oil, period.
So it's not FDA approved?
No. Mm-mm. The legislature acted in the state of Indiana. That's because they're all doctors and they know better. No, I think they're... No, I'm not going to say it. No, they're not. They're not doctors, I guess. Well, there are a few doctors, but not many.